Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. I have the pleasure of bringing to you today Michelle Gaines, who is a certified registered nurse anesthetist, an area that requires great skill and knowledge. Michelle has a master's in nurse anesthesia, which she earned in Kansas, and is working full-time as a nurse anesthetist, as well as she reviews cases as an expert witness in nurse anesthesia. She has been an invaluable resource for me, and she's a member of our LNC Success Connection, which is my membership program for legal nurse consultants. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Pat, I'm so happy to be able to spend a little time with you this afternoon.
I as well. I'm glad to know that we can talk about this issue. Your area of expertise is for people who are not in the OR, somewhat mysterious. You take a person down, put them to sleep, watch them carefully, bring them back up. And all of that sounds very simplistic, and yet it involves myriad decisions and knowledge and awareness and interaction with a surgical team. So let's talk about the current way that in the United States anesthesia is delivered and who are the providers who could be found in the OR around that anesthesia machine if it's general anesthesia. And I know not everybody gets general anesthesia in the OR. Let's talk about that model. First of all, could you describe for me or for our listener the responsibilities of the nurse anesthetist?
Well, Pat, I would like to let you read your viewers know that in the United States, in most of the big centers, what you see is the anesthesia care team model, where you have an anesthesiologist and a nurse anesthetist really working as a team together. And a lot of times people don't realize, because the CRNAs are the ones behind those swinging doors in the rooms, providing the bedside care. The patient sees the anesthesiologist that walks up to the bed in pre-op holding, does the initial interview in a lot of the circumstances. Then the nurse anesthetist will come along. If I get to the bed before the anesthesiologist, I'll do the initial interview. And if not, I'll just reintroduce myself as part of the anesthesia team, and then usually give some of that magical stuff we carry around in our pockets that makes people forget about what's going to happen. In other words, Versed. And then we take a trip back through those swinging doors to the operating room. And the anesthesiologist in most facilities will be readily available for what we call induction. If you think about an airplane taking off, it's takeoff time, so all hands on deck, everyone paying attention. And then once we've established an airway, we are in flight, so to speak. The anesthesiologist will then leave the room, and we'll talk about some of those responsibilities. And the nurse anesthetist will then monitor the patient's vital signs, make changes in the anesthesia, get the patient prepared for landing. It's funny that you mentioned the mystery that goes on. People that come in to observe just see the surgeon finishing and the patient wakes up. And when I have students with me, I remind them that anesthesia is more like landing a 747. It's not a helicopter. So we have to use pharmacology and physiology and our relationship with the surgeon, so we all come down at the same time. That's probably a little long-winded, but
Yeah, that's a great image. I've got that. You know, I was attending a conference several years ago, and there was a parliamentarian on the podium whose job it was to make decisions about whether the bylaws of this association permitted a certain thing to happen. And he was clearly daydreaming. And somebody asked him a question, and he came back to where he was, and he said, being a parliamentarian is much like being a pilot on a flight. There's a lot of excitement at the beginning and a lot of coasting, and then a lot of excitement when you're landing the plane. Could you please repeat the question?
And to that also, just like a pilot, the nurse anesthetist, we watch the surgeon. We're keeping an eye on what's going on in the operating room in general, not just our patient. But sometimes the surgeon experiences difficulty or untold consequences, and we have to be able to jump into action, start the resuscitation, if that is what we're talking about. And of course, call for the anesthesiologist, but we're moving forward with a plan of action. Anesthesiologist comes in, and then we work as a team, four hands and two brains, figuring out what we're going to do.
You've talked about being able to call in the anesthesiologist to get some additional attention. Are there settings where the nurse anesthetist is by himself or herself without a physician who is in the same building?
There certainly can be. And that goes back to the fact that a nurse anesthetist not only is certified, but also has a license to practice. And we're licensed to practice anesthesia, and we train right along with the residents. So really what guides a CRNA's practice is the Board of Nursing in that state and their regulations. Also, when you apply to a hospital, you go through a credentialing committee. And part of that, you check off boxes about areas of care that you're comfortable with, such as I would feel comfortable putting in a special IV that monitors blood pressure, but I might not check that I would do a eyeball local block because I don't have experience of sticking needles in around the eyeballs. So you would check off certain things that you feel that you're comfortable doing. That goes before the committee. They say you can practice in that facility, and then you do those things that you've been credentialed to do.
What about in outpatient surgery centers? For example, are nurse anesthetists on their own, meaning without a physician in that kind of a setting?
And once again, we're talking about who's delivering care, and nurse anesthetists are licensed anesthesia providers. And yes, they very well can. Now, what you would want to make sure of if you're reviewing charts and such, is what does that facility's policies and procedures say? In some areas of the country, just due to lack of providers, you will find we're now called nurse anesthesiologists, by the way, and we'll talk about that later. Nurse anesthetists will be practicing independently in those facilities, and the quality of care, according to the Cochrane Review study, is that it's just as safe a practice as if an anesthesiologist was delivering that care.
Tell us about the tension that may exist within the nurse anesthesia field and the physician anesthesia field. I know that historically, when physicians, MDs, share responsibilities, that doesn't always go well for the relationship between the physician and the other provider. Give us an overview about what this is like for nurses who are working in your field.
Well, I would say that most of the time, the relationship is collegial and that we work as a team. And they serve the anesthesiologists and the nurse anesthetist working together. I personally feel in my practice is one of the strongest platforms to provide really good care to the patient because we can catch things for each other. That being said, there has been historically friction between the American Society of Anesthesiologists and the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists. CRNAs have been around for over 150 years. The first providers of anesthesia at the head of the bed were actually nuns that worked in the operating room that had more like a circulating nurse's duty. And the surgeon said, hey, there's this new stuff that keeps people from moving around a lot. Why don't you get up here at the head of the bed? You look like you kind of know what you can do, and give chloroform or give these other drugs that, of course, don't exist anymore. And it was nurses and nuns in that field that then went on to develop the field of nurse anesthesia. It was after one of the world wars where we had a lot of men coming back home that needed jobs, and you had men that were trained as medics in the field of war and that had learned how to do anesthesia in that sense. And then you saw societies change. Women went home, started having families, and it just over time you saw where anesthesiologists became a field of medicine that was renowned. And I think sometimes what you'll find at the head of the bed, especially if you have nurses that have worked independently as CRNAs, that there can be a little conflict about who's driving the ship. But I would say majority time, everyone's focused on the patient.
If a legal nurse consultant were involving a case in which a nurse anesthetist was part of the care, would there necessarily be an anesthesiologist involved in that case also?
Not necessarily. And you should be able to find who's in the case by looking at the anesthesia record. All those involved are supposed to sign it. Also on how it's billed. You can look in our billing system and you'll find out who they're billing for as well.
Does the term nurse anesthesiologist set off any ripples of protest in your experience?
Well, that has just occurred. Our national association just this past year has, through a vote of the membership, just to backtrack, I'll tell you that now if you graduated from a nurse anesthesia program, you would have a doctorate in nurse anesthesia. So I think there became some conversation about doctor. One is a medical doctor. One is prepared through schooling and has a doctorate. And I think just trying to set ourselves apart from other non-doctor providers, the conversation came up that anesthesiologist is a person who provides anesthesia. And so to change the labels into nurse anesthesiologist versus physician anesthesiologist. So I think you're going to see nurse anesthesiologists popping up. What's interesting is in the state of Texas, the Board of Nursing says, So I cannot call myself a nurse anesthesiologist in the state of Texas, even though my national association wants me to.
Do you know what's behind that?
Politics, I think.
Like all sources of resistance.
But I think as legal nurse consultants are looking over records, they're going to start seeing this nurse anesthesiologist name pop up, and they need to realize it's a certified registered nurse anesthetist. And there's also the anesthesia assistant that is out there. And I think it may also be a way to delineate and make a difference between a CRNA and an anesthesia assistant.
Before we explore that role, what you said just struck me. Physical therapists, for example, are now entering the practice or entering their educational pathway with a goal that they'll come out with a doctorate. Nurse practitioners are increasingly getting their doctorates. Nurse anesthesiologists are getting their doctorates. This is part of the upgrading, if I can use that word, of the educational requirements for people in these advanced practice roles that may not be present in other countries. There may be a nurse anesthetist who's doing all of the anesthesia, or there could be an MD who's doing all the anesthesia. So it's something that we're focusing on, and I may have omitted other areas. I know that physician's assistants, for example, just changed their language recently, and I don't know the new term, but I heard that that just went in place this year, 2021. The anesthesia assistant, who you mentioned, is another player. Tell our listener who this person is. What is this person responsible for?
Well, first, I would like to just apologize to any anesthesia assistants that might be listening to our podcast in that I have no personal experience working with anesthesia assistants in my practice. So if I step on any toes, it's all because I'm seeing the world through the world of a CRNA. But anesthesia assistants are mid-level, we call them mid-level providers in the United States. It was conceived in the 1960s by anesthesiologists who wrote that they really wanted the immediate care of the patient to remain within the province of the anesthesiologists. And consequently, this personnel cannot work independently, but only under the immediate direction of an anesthesiologist. Now that wording gets really loose, and we can talk about that in a little bit. AAs are similar to PAs, physician's assistants, but they can only practice in anesthesiology. To date, I believe there are 12 programs in the United States. The program lasts approximately 2 to 2.5 years. They do graduate with a master's degree. They have a national exam that they have to pass and to become certified, but they don't, not in all states, they aren't licensed. And in the United States, currently, I believe they can practice in 17 states. But what you will see in the literature and what the American Society of Anesthesiologists puts out is that they are identically clinically capable and responsible to work in the care team model.
Are they delivering anesthesia?
Yes, ma'am. They were delivering anesthesia, and in some places through peers that have worked with them, they will tell you that they're delivering anesthesia not under the direct supervision of the anesthesiologist. So that gets real muddled about what is direct supervision and what is not.
And it raises a fascinating point, because the traditional way for nurse anesthetists to be prepared was first they had to have a bachelor's degree, then the requirement was put in place that they had to have a master's degree. I've been in nursing for a very long time. So I look back at this when I say first and then next from the standpoint of watching this since 1969. Now we have an anesthesia assistant who has to have a master's degree. Are you describing a parallel set of responsibilities to the nurse with the master's degree who's a nurse anesthesiologist?
If I'm understanding the question right, they deliver care at the bedside, I am told, just as I would be delivering care at the bedside as a CRNA. But when I have talked with people about this role, one thing, and this is coming from my perspective as someone who worked as an ICU nurse, who had leadership positions in a big surgical ICU, running codes, managing patients, calling doctors before everything got out of control. Having that kind of experience, also even going back to my basic nursing program of being taught to be the advocate for my patient, thinking of advocacy towards the patient. And for me, that's what makes my role as a CRNA different than I would think someone who just went to school, passed some tests, and I don't see the nursing advocacy and also the hands-on. It's one thing to take ACLS, advanced cardiac life support, and do a code on a dummy. And it's a lot different doing those things on human beings in dynamic situations. And I think someone can get that experience if they work in a big facility over time. But to say right out of the gate that we are the same provider, I would disagree with.
Mm-hmm. And the word anesthesia assistant, to me, implies a subservient role. We have a certified nurse assistant, a CNA, who works in a nursing home. You're describing in this role somebody who is not in that type of an assistant role. So I'm wondering if at some point in the future, we're going to see anesthesia assistants have different terminology to reflect their responsibilities and eliminating that word assistant. That's my speculation based on what you just said.
Very true. I think part of it's driven by politics, and I try to stay out of politics. But the American Society of Anesthesiologists have been very behind these anesthesia assistants. And again, they've politically tried to stop independent work. But I think you're right. I think if these people come through training, train, work right alongside nurse anesthetists, are doing the same job, if over time it shows that they're just as safe as nurse anesthetist, there may be some changes politically within them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to pull you into politics for a moment, Michelle.
Oh, no.
How has your practice changed because of COVID?
Well, I am not working at the big tertiary care centers. So when COVID first hit, one of the biggest change for me is I was potentially facing unemployment at this point in my career, because I work for a small group that covers multiple small surgical centers and doctor suites and a couple of rural health, small healthcare centers. And so it wasn't that I was immediately drawn back to my ICU role, because our numbers did not get to the point that we needed to be drafted in. They just used the people that they had. When the operating rooms came to be just emergency only, the hospitals then had plenty of CRNAs on hand to handle the ventilators and help in ICU. So I was at home on furlough. And then to go back to work, because I do work in smaller centers that don't have the big funding like the big hospitals do, I went back doing the anesthesia care. Some patients were tested, some were not. Unlike the big centers where everyone had to pass their COVID test to be able to walk through the doors, when you're working at the smaller, more rural places that don't have the funding, but yet surgery needs to happen, they're not symptomatic. So you go in with protection and you do surgery.
My friend in Florida had a outpatient total hip replacement in Florida, and she did not have to take a COVID test in order to have that surgery done.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think we want to talk about how I feel about that. I don't understand. Part of me doesn't understand how the government says that tests will be available, that tests are available to whoever wants it. And yet facilities, not all facilities are imposing that rule.
Well, my husband just had cataract surgery and we were talking about this. He went to an outpatient surgery center and he has been fully vaccinated and has received the booster. We both got Pfizer. And the anesthesiologist asked him very matter-of-factly, have you been vaccinated? And my husband said, yes. And he said, both shots. And my husband said, yes. And it made me think about the vulnerability of an anesthesiologist who has to remove that patient's mask in order to look in the back of the throat and assess the airway. Has anesthesia practice changed in any way as a result of the risk of exposure to the provider from the patients?
That's a good question. I would say, first, the way it's changed is I didn't used to approach my patients with a mask on. I would approach them. I always felt that that was too intimidating. You know, you want to show your face, show your emotion. Luckily, I haven't done a lot of children's anesthetics during this time. It would be so hard for me to approach a child without being able to smile at them and interact with them with the mask. Although we're going to have a generation of children coming that are perfectly fine with a mask. Mm-hmm. It has changed. I do quite a few endoscopies. So the upper endoscopy where the scope goes down the throat. There are times when our numbers are high and our patients may not necessarily be tested or vaccinated. And we're expected to provide that care. And even though the American Society, I'm going to get their initials wrong, of gastroenterology says that that is not an aerilization, it sure seems to me like putting that scope down that's blowing air very well is an aerilization. When I'm doing those cases, I have a mask that looks more like a snorkel mask. It's more of a heavy duty. Darth Vader's sister is mm-hmm. what I tell people. And I still wear that if in those situations to protect myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that there's been a lot of discussion about which types of masks are most effective. Certainly outside the OR, the question is a cloth mask effective? Do you need to have a cloth mask and a paper mask together? I would hope that the type of mask available to people who are sitting on your type of chair is even better than the paper mask that we commonly think of as being ones that surgeons wore or OR staff wore prior to 2020.
I will say that right now, masks are plentiful. We can get an N95 pretty easily. When COVID first started, it was scary how we did not have masks and we had to come up with some things on our own. And it was interesting to see the people that are creative in the field that came up with even building frames out of PVC pipe, covering with plastic and then intubating through that so that you were out of the flume. We've done some interesting things. And I have to say, Pat, for our whole anesthesia group, there's 30 of us in this group. And to my knowledge, only two have actually come down with COVID while we've been working. And I would say we work in a high risk area. So I think that the things that we've done to protect ourselves are working.
Mm-hmm. How can our listener find out more about you, your services, how to contact you?
Well, I do not have a website because I'm a busy girl and I don't need one more thing to take care of, but I am on LinkedIn and my email is my name, Michelle with two L's at, and then it's my initials. So M as in Mary, M as in Mary again, and then my last name, Gaines.com. So Michelle at mmgaines.com or LinkedIn.
Okay. And can you spell your last name?
Gaines.
Well, Michelle, it's been very helpful to get an inside world into what goes on behind those swinging doors, as you described it at the beginning of this show. I am even more convinced than I was before we started talking about the complexities of what goes on in your role. And we haven't even talked about any of the clinical complexities. We've talked about the positional complexities, the responsibilities, the politics that go into naming individuals who work in the OR delivering anesthesia, some of the trends in naming that are present and will probably continue to evolve. Thanks so much for participating in this episode of Legal Nurse Podcast. And for you who is watching this, please be sure to like this podcast if you're listening to it on our audio channels, or go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com to catch the episode on our website, or you can also find podcast episodes on YouTube channel, Legal Nurse Business. Thanks so much, and be sure to catch our next podcast. This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Meet Amy Poles. We have just been talking about how she built her business from zero to a part-time business. And the other part of her world is being a nurse practitioner. Amy, what were some of the key points that we covered in your podcast?
So some of the key points in our podcast was, first of all, how to connect with attorney clients, how to choose which ones you connect with, and how to reach them on LinkedIn without doing any cold calls, any cold emails, but simply connecting with them on a professional and intellectual level. And also how to gain extra followers on LinkedIn by using things like hashtags, something that we're all used to on other social media sites, but maybe not as accustomed to that on LinkedIn. And then how to follow up with your attorney clients so you keep them coming back.
Excellent. Be sure to catch Amy's podcast. She's going to share some very practical step-by-step information about how to use LinkedIn, a tool that is sitting on your computer that you might not be thinking about as a way to get exposure and to gently and persistently put yourself in front of attorney clients in a very easy way. Requires effort, as everything does in building your business, but it is not a difficult problem or a difficult series of steps that Amy shares. It requires attention, and I think you'll get a lot out of her show. Be sure to catch Amy Poles' podcast.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.